Dr. J Interviews is a collection of candid conversations with good Black professional men regarding life and career choices. I'm your host, Dr. J McCarthy. I would like to welcome to my show, Malcolm McGuire. How you doing today, brother?
I'm doing well, brother. Thank you.
That sounds good, man. I'm going to share with the audience how I was introduced to you a little bit later on in the show. But I was looking over your resume prior to the interview, and it's quite extensive. We'll have some time to cover it all, but let's just dive right in and discuss what you're currently doing right now for a living.
Sure. So currently, I am a investigator for the Hartford Financial Services Group, which is an insurance company, probably about the same size as a Liberty Mutual or a State Farm. My current role is basically to investigate potentially fraudulent insurance claims. And that covers the gamut of, auto property and burglary, all the way to hail damage and property damage to both vehicles and houses and buildings, and workers' compensation, arsons, stolen vehicles. We pretty much do it all. Anytime there's any question about whether or not an insurance claim is on the up and up, we get the opportunity to do some digging.
So what's the what degrees, or are there any degrees required for what you do?
So what I do requires more experience than a degree, to be honest with you, because the kinds of people who are selected to be investigators for an insurance company come from one of two different kinds of backgrounds. You either have experience as a claim adjuster handling insurance claims, or you have some sort of law enforcement or military experience. I would say that a minimum of a bachelor's degree would probably be what would be required for a claims adjuster, just to get your foot in the door.
What could someone expect, just like a spectrum or a salary range for someone in that position starting off?
So the salary ranges, as I understand them, I didn't come into this and I'm sure we'll get into this later, but I didn't come into this as an insurance adjuster. So I kind of skipped some of those levels. But as it's been explained to me, it starts out in about the $60,000 range.
Okay. I think it'd actually be a good time right now to kind of pivot and show how we know each other. We share a mutual friend, and I was initially reached out to Mr. McGuire to see if he could speak to some of my ball club members to try to bridge police and community relations. Our mutual friend, he speaks so highly of you, and he's put us on some stuff together, like in text or whatnot.
Sure.
And due to this COVID, it was just kind of hard to get the kids together. So we figured this podcast would be a good way to do that. So I guess that kind of entails, can you share a little bit about your background or your previous profession?
Sure. So actually, the mutual friend that you speak of is a good friend of mine, a good fraternity brother of mine. We've known each other probably about 15 years now. And he has been in my life for the majority of my previous profession. And so in that profession I worked in law enforcement for just over 13 years. I have worked for a municipality. So I've worked for a city police department. I have worked for a university. And so I've kind of gotten to see the both ends of that spectrum, but we've been in contact for a very long time. So I joined a police department out in East Texas right out of college. I'm talking the week after I graduated, I started the police academy.
Wow.
And I stayed down there for about 4 years, and my father unfortunately got terminally ill and retired up in the North Texas area. So we ended up moving up to North Texas, and I've been in North Texas since 2006, where I stayed for another 10 years before leaving the law enforcement profession to go into the private sector and working for insurance companies like I do now.
I would assume with both of the professions you had, no day is the same. What's a typical day like for both of those?
Wow. Okay. I'll start with the more interesting one. So law enforcement, I've worked in several different capacities. So I've worked in patrol. I've been an investigator or a detective, as they're known in other areas. I've worked in training. So I've been responsible for training new officers at police academies and teaching classes. And I've been a supervisor. So there's no typical day, but I would say for a patrol officer, your typical day is typically you come to work, and you know, a lot of times you'll see on television a bunch of officers sitting in one room, and there's usually one person who's kind of, you know, giving them their notes for the day and things they need to be paying attention to and stuff like that. So that really happens. That's a real thing. So these briefings these officers go through, this is, I know you see it on television and like, no, they can't really just be sitting around. No, that's how the day starts. So after that, you get ready and you go out onto the street and you assign whatever part of the city you're assigned to. And that's really where the whole community policing aspect of things is supposed to start, because the expectation is that each officer is going to be knowledgeable of the area where they work. And that's a big reason why a lot of police officers work where they grew up, because it's just that much easier for them to go ahead and be comfortable and to know the areas and know the things to look out for. So, throughout the day, you come across, oh goodness, hundreds of different types of things. But the most important part is connecting with your community and understanding the problems that exist in that particular area. In terms of insurance, my typical day now during COVID is really doing what I'm doing now, sitting behind a desk, to be honest with you. But my job is what we call remote. So I don't work in an office. I'm sitting in my house right now. But even when we weren't in the pandemic, I was not at home. I'm sorry, I was not in an office. I was out and about. So the company provides me with a company car. I have a cell company cell phone. They provide me with a laptop so that I can work on the go, as it were, because we all have different assigned territories. My territory is actually most of, well, I'll give you an idea. So I work Southern Dallas, Southern Tarrant County, all the way down to Killeen, Texas. And from there, I work all the way out to the Louisiana-Texas border. And from there, I work all the way out to about El Paso, Texas, on the west side of the state. So I have a lot of ground to cover. And
Sounds
so I am typically in my car or on the road heading somewhere to do something for someone. So there is no typical day for me, but from the beginning of it, it's basically reviewing different files, reviewing cases that need to be looked at, setting up, appointments to talk to people, whether it's over the phone or in person. And we do a lot of different things. We interview a lot of people, do a lot of interviewing of claimants and witnesses and people who we insure. We go out to a lot of scenes. Unfortunately, I've had to work some investigations where people have passed away for, while at work, and investigate things like that. So it's there's a lot that comes in that, but there's no typical day, but it's always interesting.
It sounds like it. Two quick questions about law enforcement.
Sure.
Same question. What is the salary range that someone would expect trying to get into that career field?
So that will depend on the agency where you choose. Typically, your sheriff's departments, which are responsible for the county, and actually you're responsible for the jails in most well, in Texas, everywhere, they're going to pay a little bit less. And to be honest with you, a lot of that has to do with the educational requirements are a little lower. Working for a city, you're going to the salary range is going to be higher. But in terms of North Texas, I'll just give you an example. In North Texas, you're looking probably in the $65,000 to $70,000 range starting off. If you go to an agency and you already have some law enforcement experience, that will bump you up even higher. I know of agencies now that are hiring certified officers, that is officers who are already have a peace officer certification, starting them out at $80,000.
Wow. Then that was going to be my second question. I was browsing through your resume. Can you explain to me what a Master Peace Officer certification is?
So when you graduate from a police academy in the state of Texas, you get a basic police officer certification. That means you've met the basic amount, minimum amount of requirements to be a certified peace officer in the state. There's a combination of things that can help you move from basic to an intermediate. Those things are amount of training hours in a year. You can combine those with education. If you have military experience, you can combine that as well. So it goes basic, intermediate, and then master peace officer. So a master peace officer is as high as you can go in terms of certification. So that's what that is. It's basically saying that you have the requisite amount of hours and education and training to carry that particular certificate.
Okay, that makes sense. Another thing that stood out when I was looking through, I see that you're an adjunct instructor at the local community college. And one of the things that need a little clarification, you said that you instruct courses between law enforcement and minority juveniles, as well as the internal police culture. Can you discuss that a little bit about what that's
Sure,
involved in?
absolutely. So the adjunct instructor position that I have now is at Tarrant County College in the Northwest campus in Fort Worth, Texas. And it's basically what we call a regional academy. And it's a regional academy because departments who are not large enough to have their own internal police academy will send their new cadets, their new hires to a regional academy where they are trained alongside other smaller agencies. And so, you know, I could go teach a academy class at TCC and there would be maybe six or seven different agencies who've sent recruits to the to their academy. So that's a regional academy. What you're referring to with the disproportionate minority portion, that's a separate job, I guess. That's a consulting position that I've had for a few years now. It's tied to the Department of Justice, where I am. I get the opportunity to help construct courses for agencies around the country. And so what you're talking about specifically, it's a course called Disproportionate Minority Contact for minority juveniles between law enforcement and juveniles. And basically what it is, it's a class that discusses some alternative ways to deal with juveniles as opposed to just locking everybody up. And I think the biggest disparity that there is between minority juveniles who are contacted by law enforcement and anyone else. And I'm actually pretty proud of that course because that course was actually picked up by the state of Florida and it's still being taught today in Florida by the Department of Juvenile Justice in Florida. So I'm working on a class right now called Police Culture that basically deals with the internal culture of law enforcement and how sometimes there's some disparity between how law enforcement is viewed and how law enforcement views themselves.
You know, that's awesome because I think that'll go right into the next point. Of course, you know, in lieu of everything that's going on right now, we need to, you know, bring up police brutality. Of course, with this global Black Lives Matters movement, the events surrounding George Floyd, you know, we have a responsibility to address some of these fears. And I think
Absolutely.
it's good to have someone from a different perspective. And like I said, as you know, there's so many names. We got Breonna Taylor,
Yes.
Trayvon, Philando Castile, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner. You have ones people may not talk about that much, Stephen Clark, Alton Sterling, Janisha Fonville, and the list goes on and on. And you look online and you see the ratio of the black men and women are being killed. I think I read somewhere that's like 28% of those killed by police in 2013 or since 2013 have been blacks, despite us only being 13% of the population. So,
Right.
you know, that's disheartening. So I do have a question for you. What I want to do is I want to give you a little bit about my background, and then we can just dive right into it. And I think that we've discussed this briefly before. I'm from Ohio. I grew up in the inner city, you know, and when I was younger, my mother had a stroke. All right. I didn't have a father around, and I needed a car to get back and forth. So saved my money, got a car. One of my buddies' father looked out for me. Somebody's church was selling a car. Anybody that's in the cars, you know, I got an 82 Delta 88.
Ooh, okay.
Now, so it's smooth, but you know, there's a perception that goes along with that car, you know. So I do understand that as an adult. You know, it looks like a D-Boy's car. But I purchased it, you know, I worked hard for it, I registered it, I got insurance, I did everything by the book. And I can't tell you how many times that I got pulled over, you know,
Sure.
being profiled just because of my car. Now, I'm a good, responsible kid, you know, and I got into mischief like any other teen, you know, but nothing illegal. And I felt like they were picking on me, trying to get a reaction, you know, and I just got pulled over for like driving 25 and a 30 or looking suspicious and things like that. And my mother taught me how to, you know, before she got sick, you know, how to react, you know, not get an attitude, you know, your disposition. But it's still, you know, I guess when I look at these people that lost their lives, I feel blessed, you know,
Sure.
blessed to have my life. And it's minuscule in comparison, but I can't negate, you know, that those experiences are still part of my psyche, you know, and I don't get pulled over as much. But it has occurred in my adulthood, you know, and you kind of know the area that we live in. We're
Sure.
middle class and we're in affluent communities now. And when I see, and I'll just be straight transparent, you know, when I see the flash of the blue and red, it doesn't register in my mind that this is protection. You know, I immediately wonder what I'm gonna get harassed for. You know, I make sure when I see them behind, I don't veer on the road, I don't touch the inner lane, I can
Right.
turn perfect. You look back like, man, that is emotionally traumatizing. You know, I'm in my 40s.
Yeah.
Taxpaying citizen, I'm registered, legal, insured, good
Right.
father, good friend. I work hard, I'm educated. But at the end of the day, I still have the same fears that I had as a 17-year-old teen because it doesn't matter if I'm seen as less than human. You know, it's like no matter how much we fight to change these stereotypes perpetuated,
Yeah.
you know, we get pulled over by certain officers, and I'm not typecasting all of them, you know, but it seems like none of that matters. And then personally, to compile that anxiety, I got four sons of driving age that I gotta worry about right now, you
Right.
know. So, and I'm sorry for this rant, but I just kind of want to give you a black background And just be like I said, be transparent. So this leads to my question for you from a law enforcement perspective. What can you say to young black men, young and old black men alike, to assist them in handling these encounters with police the safest way possible from your perspective? What do I, you know, the slogan they have going on right now is return home safe to me. You see these commercials.
Sure.
What do I tell my sons to make sure that they come home safe to me?
First of all, thank you for that. I didn't consider it a rant. I think it's more of just, yeah, I think we can all echo everything you just said, everyone, no matter where you're from. And it's compounded for me as well, because I have two teenagers, both boys. My oldest is 15. He's just now starting to drive with us in the car, obviously, but it's a concern. And I can tell you from experience, and I tell people all this all the time, I said, because there's a lot of pressure, added pressure on black police officers days for a myriad of reasons. But I think one thing that a lot of people forget is that once we take that uniform off, just black people like everybody else. I actually saw a video the other day of a young lady in a uniform who'd been pulled over and was tearful because of the way she was treated. And she was in uniform. It was ridiculous. But as far as advice on what you could do, it almost sounds kind of cliche coming out of my mouth, and I hate saying it. Because typically what we've always been told is just comply, just do what you're supposed to do and you'll be fine. I think we've seen recently that that's not always going to be the case. And I'm not going to sit up here and try to feed anybody any level of misinformation saying, hey, just do what you're told to do and everything will be fine. Right. Absolutely not. The very first thing I would say, and this is what I tell my own sons, is obviously be polite, be respectful. A lot of times the younger generation these days confuses be polite, be respectful with be subservient. Not the same thing. Don't give an officer any reason to believe that you would cause some sort of danger to them. Because I'll tell you, from a training standpoint, from a police officer standpoint, the number one thing you hear officers say after some sort of use of force incident is, I feared for my life. Or they were making some sort of furtive movement, or they were doing something that, you know, was kind of sketchy. So that would be my initial advice, is don't give them a reason to make that kind of statement. And full transparency, I have these same conversations when I teach officers. I just taught a class at Southern Methodist University 2 weeks ago on cultural diversity and community interaction. And I had the same conversation. We got into the whole Blue Lives Matter, thin blue line stuff. And, you know, it was an uncomfortable discussion, but it was one that needed to be had, because police officers are trained, just like you were saying earlier, about how, you know, we want to be able to tell our sons and daughters what to do to be able to come home. I guarantee you, that in every single academy, and at least in the state of Texas that I know of, officers are being told a similar mantra. And that's basically, you got to do what you have to do to come home at night. Right. So it's two different perspectives, same message.
Yeah.
The only difference is these officers are the ones walking around with instruments of death on their hip, and everybody else is not. And so for me, it's a training issue. And even more, a little deeper than that, it's an issue of the heart. You know, it goes back to recruiting and hiring and retention. There are a lot of officers in this country who should not be police officers for a myriad of reasons. But going back to your original question, I feel like the best advice I could give a young man who looks like you and I is to be polite, be respectful, and follow the instructions that are given to you. But, you know, don't let anyone take advantage of you. You know, don't put yourself in a position where that has to be the case.
Can you address what are our rights if they say, I need to search your vehicle? Because you hear stuff, you know, you don't know what's legal and what's not, you know, and I have to admit myself, I'm ignorant to a lot of that stuff. You know, I just live my life and I do, you know, that's not in the forefront until I get pulled over. And then you like, you wish you had that kind of knowledge. And you see these videos on YouTube of people saying, know your rights. You could say this, or you could ask for this and that. So from a law enforcement perspective, what are our rights?
In terms of what? Are we talking about in terms of searching your vehicle, your persons, stopping and talking to you?
If they, you know, can they just stop anyone? Do you have to allow them to search your vehicle? what you should say in these kind of situations?
Well, I think the number one thing is people need to understand exactly how much power the people have. Law enforcement is bound by more rules, not just state law, but their own department policies than people even realize. So let's take an example of someone walking down the street. Okay. Just anyone just walking down the street and an officer starts to talk to him. At that point, that's what we would call just a consent contact, right? That's just me stopping and saying, hey, how you doing? All that kind of stuff. Now, if a consent contact doesn't include anything enforcement related, like you don't have a what we call probable cause or even a lower level of reasonable suspicion to believe that someone's doing something illegal. It's just a consent contact. You have every right to tell that officer, I don't want to talk to you and keep walking. That officer has no legal reason to detain you any further, right? If an officer has a quote unquote legal reason to stop you, you can consider yourself detained at that time. But even then, that doesn't mean that they have a right to search you. And you can at any point refuse to be searched, right? And just to be fully transparent, a lot of these municipalities and they have different kind of ordinances and minor laws that make it easier for law enforcement to target people. Right. I'll give you an example. In the state of Texas, if you are walking in the road, you know, it doesn't even have to be in the middle of the road, just in the road, but there's a sidewalk right there, the officer has a legal reason to stop you because that's actually against the law. It's called walking where a sidewalk is provided. It's really, really silly, but it exists.
Yeah.
Right. You know, riding your bicycle on the wrong side of the street, that gives an officer a legal reason to stop you and talk to you. Stuff that we would not even consider, but, you know, having gone through a lot of the training and things like that, you pick up on it. But you always have the right to tell them no. Now, let's move on to a vehicle stop, because that's kind of the more popular one, right? You get pulled over in your vehicle and an officer, asks to search your vehicle. There's nothing stopping you from asking them why, right? And again, you can still refuse. And I would, to be honest with you, especially if you know that you haven't done anything wrong, there's nothing in your vehicle you need to be concerned about. Officers are trained to look for certain things, for certain behaviors. And a lot of it is just things that people do every day, and it's not as big a deal. And so that, again, that goes back to what I was saying about the training that officers receive, you know. It's a little light on the humanity and a little heavy on the enforcement. And we need to bridge that gap. But I just wanted to point out that it's always, always okay for you to.
What I like, and I want to pause before I ask the second question and applaud you for the programs that you're implementing. I think that, well, let me go back to my situation. When I was growing up, I drew, you know, majority black churches, all black neighborhoods, majority black schools. And when I went to college, that was kind of a culture shock. It was the first time that I had to, you know, really interact with different races on that level. And my roommate was a white guy, and he came from a small town. And in that moment, I learned so much from him. I realized, one, especially going to that university, how many more white people there are than black people. You don't think about these things because black people traditionally migrate to cities, especially in Ohio. You know, we migrate to Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, the major cities. But there are all these towns in between.
Right.
And when I had dialogue with him, one of the things I realized is when they don't have black people in their community, they only have one or two. The only perception they have is television. So if you're watching things like Boys in the Hood, when they're driving certain cars, you know, the famous theme with the shotgun, or you're watching these videos and it's there, you know, I have to take into account some people don't have interactions with us, and that's the perception they have. So I think what you do in these classes of cultural awareness, I think it's really big on bridging that gap. Just like you said, my car growing up, when I get older, I realize that, you know, it's a D-boy car. You know, it had tint on the windows, it had rims. But if they knew me, it's just like, man, I was the most docile kid. You know, I didn't want no problems, you know. But when you see certain things, you associate it with certain things, cultural things that they see. The second question I have, and we keep hearing this on the news, is this defunding the police. You know, now I get the goal is to change the public perspective. But what I've read, there's two basic theories on that. Some people, the supporters of divestment, want to reallocate some, but not all the funds away from the police department to different social services. And they want to reduce the contact to the public, thinking that that will reduce the likelihood of police violence. And then the other ones are just seeking to disband the police and consider defund an initial step towards creating an entirely different model of community-led public safety. Now, I have opinions about, you know, that I get they're both ends of the spectrum, you know, and I see that they're kind of interconnected because they're trying to change public safety. But from your experience, what are your views on this defunding the police thing? And can you give us some additional insight that we might not be thinking about?
Oddly enough, I agree with defunding police departments. I think it's an amazing idea. I think that when people hear the word defunding or hear the phrase defunding, they hear it, they can read it, but abolishing is what's in their mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why this is a good idea to make sure we're clarifying. So I don't have an issue with defunding. I think it's a good idea. I think that there are a plethora of programs in our communities that need more money. I'll give you an example. There's the local department here in my city has decided to take some of the vacant officer positions that they have and put those towards creating a mental health unit that would pair police officers with psychologists. Hope I'm saying that right. Well, social workers who will assist in responding to calls that involve your MHMR and people with disabilities, as opposed to just officers showing up, because these officers are not qualified to deal with people in this manner. So that's an example of how taking resources and putting it in another place that still aids the overall public safety mission. But no, I think defunding the police is a really good idea, and I hope that everyone is really seriously thinking about it, because again, we need that money elsewhere.
Yeah.
We need that money elsewhere. And, the second part of that, abolishing, for me, it sounds like an emotional response. But I think that there is a perspective that bears hearing out.
Exactly.
And I think that's where we run into issues, is where we immediately get so defensive. And my first thought is not, why are people saying, or not getting defensive about people wanting to abolish police departments, but let's find out why.
Exactly.
Why do people want to abolish police departments? Maybe it's because they've only met officers in an enforcement manner, and that's the only way they know police officers. I would want to get rid of us too.
Yeah.
Now, having done the job and seen the things I've seen, I don't know who else would do it, but I'd love to hear some options. I think the city of San Francisco up in California is not thinking about it. I think they're already implementing. They're not sending officers to calls that don't that aren't typical, quote unquote, violent in nature. So we'll see how that works. To me, it sounds like a first step, but I don't see abolishment as a realistic thing. But I'm 100% on board with defunding if it's going to send some more money to some other deserving programs.
That's awesome. I have one more question. I'm sorry to put you on the spot here because I didn't have this prior to, right before we get into the background.
Okay.
What's your favorite, most realistic, and I'm sure you get this all the time, either cop series or cop movie?
Oh, I can see it and I can't think of the name of it. Southland is the most realistic cop show I've seen. I don't know that I can think of. Well, there was another one movie that I saw here a few years ago. It had Jake Gyllenhaal in it, and I think Michael Pena was the other one. It's about some two LAPD police officers. They were partners, but that was probably the most realistic that I've seen. I gotta think of the name of that. I'll get it to you. But no, Southland is the most realistic police show I've seen.
Nice. I remember that. That was pretty good.
Yeah,
that was pretty good. All right, so let's go ahead and get off that heavy stuff. but you know what? This is one of the reasons why I really wanted you on here, because I think it's good that people hear your perspective and any kind of relationship you have, relationship with your wife or your children, you have to have communication, you know, and it has to be two way. Sometimes we need to get on the other side and find out what's going on. So I really appreciate that invaluable information.
Sure.
let's talk about your childhood and we try to see how we got to where you are. You tell me a little bit about your household growing up and your childhood.
Oh man, I'm still not sure how I got here. so I grew up, I was born in Linwood, California, which is a city in Los Angeles County, just outside of Compton. I grew up all over LA. So I lived in one of those families where we moved like every 5 years, but we stayed in the county. We stayed in LA County, which is huge. But, I lived in Compton, and then we moved to West LA and a couple other places. And I finally settled in Pasadena, California, home of the Rose Bowl. And so that's where I went to junior high. I went to high school there, and I graduated from high school. Kind of poked around a little bit, to be honest with you. I did. I was one of those kids that I was bored by school. Like, school didn't interest me. I was always a smart kid. I just didn't want to do what other kids were doing. And so I bounced around a couple junior colleges, really just appeasing my father, to be honest with you, and not get kicked out. And one day, a good friend of mine who I grew up with, she told me she'd applied and been accepted to a small HBCU in East Texas called Wiley College. And she said, "Hey, you should apply and come with me." I'm like, "What are you talking about? Like, I don't know anything about HBCUs." So, but I did. I applied and got accepted and ended up in Marshall, Texas, a town of 25,000 people that was still partially segregated in 1998. And this is coming from LA. So you talk about a culture shock. So you were talking about growing up around mostly Black people and then integrating. Well, my experience was the exact opposite. I grew up in the melting pot that was Los Angeles, California. And then coming to Wiley College, which is nothing but Black. That's the first time I'd ever been around nothing but Black people. So, you know, I had to weather the questions about, "Oh, you from LA? Do you know Shaq?" All that kind of stuff. And I'm like, "Okay, this is weird." But I grew to love it. I grew to love it. I tried to come home, I think the first year, and Pops wasn't having that. So ended up staying. I ended up graduating from Wiley College. And so a little bit about my background as far as my family goes. I'm the youngest of six boys.
Oh, wow.
And I also have four sisters.
Okay. Right.
So we call ourselves the Black Brady Bunch because my parents were both married once before. And my mother had all girls. My father had all boys. I'm the only product of their union. Right.
Oh, nice.
So I'm the baby boy and I'm way younger than my siblings. So fun fact, of my six of my dad's six sons, five of us have been police officers. So it's kind of just, and I attribute it to our upbringing. Uh-huh. You know, my dad always said, "You guys are going to probably end up being police officers or preachers, depending on which one you decide." I have one brother who's actually both, but I was the youngest. So yeah, I got recruited to go work for a police department right out of college. And you know, I went and joined that profession. And you know, that was my start on my professional journey. But while in college, I met my wife. She was right. we've been together since 99. I think we met freshman orientation. So we've been together a long time. She's a nurse. My wife is a cardiovascular nurse up here in the North Texas area. And we have two boys, 15 and 13. Our oldest is a football player, played sophomore at a high school up here. And then my youngest is actually playing club soccer. So he takes up all my money. so the majority of my free time is spent traveling with him to practices and games and stuff like that. So, you know, that's me in a nutshell.
What was your degree in?
My bachelor's degree was in English literature, actually. When I got to school, I wanted to be a mass comm major. In high school, I used to write for the school paper, and I thought I was going to be some big time journalist. And I got to college, and my first year, they did away with the mass communications program, and I had to find another major. I picked English because I love to read and write. Uh-huh. And you know, and you a brother, taking Shakespeare, you know, that don't come off as too cool. I really enjoy my college experience. I play baseball as well, so I got to stay active and do some things. But yeah, no, English was my undergrad, and then I eventually got my master's degree in dispute resolution and conflict management at SMU up here in Dallas.
Nice. What do you, and I had another guest, same question I asked him. Mm-hmm. What do you feel the importance of HBCUs are?
I think they're more important than ever. Now we all know that, you know, HBCUs were created because we didn't have an option to go anywhere else, to be honest with you. And the majority of them focused on education because that was what we lacked as people more than anything else. Education and obviously the farming aspect of things. I think they're more important now than any other time because you're not going to be able to go anywhere else in this world as a black man or a black woman where you're not going to be the minority at anywhere else but an HBCU. You know, you have the rest of your life to be looking over your shoulder and concerned about how you're viewed and all that other kind of stuff. You can truly be amongst family for 4 years. And I encourage anyone. I love, you know, I've worked at a PWI. I obviously got my master's degree from one, but I'm telling you, if you have an opportunity to go, just go visit. I promise you, once you go visit an HBCU, you're going to want to go to one. You know, those college tours are the truth. So, you know, you use that, use those 4 years to be stress-free before you hit the real world.
Hey, nothing wrong with that, brother. Nothing wrong with that. All right, so now we're at the point in the interview where I ask you the perspective questions I ask all my guests.
Okay.
So the first one is, you know, we've talked about your past, and we know that everything you went through, it formed you to be the man that you are. You had to go through those things that were necessary. But if you're older, you can go back and talk to the younger you. What would you tell yourself to help navigate that road?
I would have taken school way more seriously, much sooner. Much sooner. And when I think about the I've been given so many different opportunities. God has really been good to me. But I was a late bloomer educationally. You know, I didn't barely make it out of high school, but I probably could have. It probably could have been close. matter of fact, I'll tell you a quick story. My father actually, I remember my senior year, he had a meeting with the guidance counselor. And he had a guidance counselor actually tell him that I was not college material. And that I should look into going to the military. And it's because I just, you know, I was nonchalant and indifferent to everything. Right. And my dad never told me that. My father passed away about 12 years ago. And my mother was the one who told me. I never knew this conversation took place. And I'm sitting here, you know, 2 degrees post high school. And I wasn't even, according to the counselor, not supposed to be college material. Right. So I would have taken it serious a lot sooner. Like I like to write and I like playing baseball. I didn't care about anything else in high school. So I would have taken a lot more serious, even in college. I would have done a lot more, educationally than I, you know, I felt like I did. So I think the sooner you take education seriously, number one, you'll be taken more seriously, but number two, it's going to open up more avenues for you the earlier you start.
I agree wholeheartedly. Second question, I'm a big proponent of strengthening one's mind, body, and spirit. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me how you personally strengthen one or either all three of these areas?
Mind, body, and spirit. Well, body is actually an easy one because I have the athletes that I have as kids. So I have to keep up with them. I have to let them know the old man still can get with them when I need to. But it's just important. It's important to be able to take care of myself so that I can be around for them, so that I can be around to see them and see their kids. So they're my motivation for taking care of myself physically. Spirit is probably even easier. I belong to Antioch Christian Fellowship in Corinth, Texas, and I have a really genuine relationship with my pastor, and he's a moral center for me, but he is, you know, he makes it so much easier for me to stay in touch with my spiritual self. And, you know, he's that angel on my shoulder to keep me from saying some of the stuff I want to say, but, that part is not as difficult. My mind is the problem because I say that because I'm one of those people that wants to do everything. Like I have a hard time sometimes focusing on one task or two tasks because I feel like I can contribute in so many different ways. I think that the centralizing key for me is to focus on a task and do it to the best of my ability. You know, we are a special people and there's just so much that we can do, but you know, we have to learn to share the wealth and not try and be everything to everyone. So I think the as far as the mind goes, it's just focus. Focus has got to be the key.
Now, you had said something, you just mentioned that you like to do a lot of things. I made a couple of notes that I'm going to go back to these because I forgot to cover this.
Okay.
I see in your resume, you also have, you've done classes in Rwanda, Kenya, and you also served in the Air Force Reserve as well.
I did.
Boy, you did. Hey, man, when I said this guy's resume is impressive, I was reading this thing and I was just like, wow. You know, you read it and you're like, I need to get on the ball myself.
I appreciate that. No, going to Africa really changed my life and changed my worldview, my cultural worldview. Going to Rwanda, and first of all, you've never been to Rwanda. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Hotel Rwanda.
Yes.
You know, I got a chance to actually go to that hotel. We got a chance to view or visit the genocide memorial. I've been to the cemetery where most of the bodies are. And, you know, I've had conversations with both Hutus and Tutsis, and it is what I call the epitome of conflict resolution. Because if there's any place in the world where two opposing sides are now living and working together, it's Rwanda. It's Kigali, really the capital where it all happened. And that was a life-changing experience for me. So I got a chance to go in 2014 to with a team of other people to teach some classes to some of their local public safety officials, I guess kind of a police department, and as well as some of the Rwanda National Guard, who are their actual police department. And that was an experience. I've taught a lot of places around the state. That's the first time I'd ever had a chance to teach using an interpreter. I realized that Africa is extremely relational in terms of time. Time is just a word there. Here in the States, you break from a class, you know, you do 45 minutes, you take 15 minute break, you come back, you do another 45 minutes. In Africa, you break, there's coffee and tea and cookies, there's dancing, there's singing. Who knows when you're coming back to actually start the class all over again. But if nothing else, that taught me that it's important to be relational. I'm in contact. It's been 6 years. I'm in contact today with people from Rwanda that I met, and it was life changing. But and hopefully, you know, a lot of the training we brought was helpful. But you until you get a chance to experience the culture somewhere else, it makes you appreciative to a certain standpoint. But it also kind of makes you feel like we're missing out on something, because that's just not something we do well in this country. We don't relate to each other well. We don't show that level of humanity. And to see that, especially in some place like Rwanda, where the only kind of like you said, the only thing you've seen on television is the movie where, you know, folks are slaughtering each other, you know, and then you go there and you see people from opposing tribes I've had plenty of people tell me, you know, I've had people ask, you know, are you Tutsi? Are you Hutu? And they were like, I'm just Rwandan. Like, they don't even make those same classifications anymore. And when I went there, it was the 20th anniversary. So that was a big deal. So we're talking 94 to 2014. It was a big deal. And it'll change your life. It really will. I miss the Air Force. I've got a chance to do some things in the Air Force in terms of training. I got to do some training in Saudi Arabia during Operation Enduring Freedom. And, you know, it was a good time. Some of the best, I think probably best 7 years I've spent was being a part of the military.
Awesome. And, you know, and to go back to what you said, we don't do that here. I feel because we don't want to, you know, right. I don't feel there's a desire for humanity, and I don't want to keep beating a dead horse, but, you know, from a black man's perspective, you're sitting here and let's talk about Michael Vick, for example.
Sure.
You know, Michael Vick grew up, most of us know his story, you know, single family home, and, you know, crazy athletic. He goes on to do great things, but because of his loyalty to some knucklehead friends, and we've all had friends probably even to this day that we probably shouldn't have in our lives, you know, it's not like he was physically out there fighting these dogs, you know, and it's not that I'm not condoning this, but what I am saying is it's the way that man was persecuted and the outrage that people had
still do towards
this man. He's still doing tours where he's apologizing, you know, and this is over a dog, and I love dogs, you know, don't get me wrong. But on the same note, we don't see this same humanity towards Breonna Taylor, you know, or these other names.
Right.
And it's I'm glad this Black Lives thing took a, you know, a turn for the better, you know, went globally. It recognized it engages in conversation like this. People that didn't know how we were feeling are starting to hear things. I hope that it goes in the right direction.
Sure.
But it's at least initiated the conversation, you know, and along those lines, I appreciate this conversation with you. The last question I have actually is there anything over this conversation that we didn't cover that you wanted to share with young brothers or anybody seeking a career change?
I will say this from someone who's worn a few different hats, from a black man who has worked in law enforcement, who still is kind of sort of a little bit dip his toe in the law enforcement water as an instructor. I want young brothers to understand, and young sisters as well, to understand that specifically black law enforcement officers, when they take that uniform off, they're just like you. And I think that it's important to remember that the only way you're going to see the humanity in people and to learn how they really feel about stuff is to engage with them. You know, there's been a whole lot made of this whole of the Blue Lives Matter response to Black Lives Matter, which I think is ridiculous. I think it's petty and it's childish. Blue Lives Matter is not a thing, because you take your uniform off, black just like me. That's my own personal stance on it. However, I will say that I think people need to see need to try and see the humanity in these officers. And on that same token, these officers need to make it easier to see the humanity in them. When you reinforce the stereotypes, it's real hard to try and get people to want to care about your life. The other part of that is I would encourage, and it's difficult for us because we are so untrusting of law enforcement. I grew up in LA in the 80s. I get it. Trust me, I get it. But you know, it's going to take some coming together, but think about doing some things like, you know, visiting your local departments, going to some of these citizen police academies, do a ride along, you know, find an officer that you trust, do a ride along, learn to kind of see or get a little bit of perspective about what it looks like from their eyes. And you may find there's more common ground than we're aware of.
I agree. And I think one of my biggest thing is I always teach my son. I teach character. I teach, you know, a true measure of a man is not what you do when people see it. It's what you do when people aren't looking, you know?
Right.
And I'm always talking about accountability. And I feel like if laws would change, you know, I do understand we have to protect officers, and I'm not saying that, but I do know that when they're able to do certain things and there's no consequence for their actions,
right,
they're going to continue to do that. And then the public is going to continue to be outraged. So until some of that changes and they know, like, hey, even if I don't feel like changing or showing humanity, that my butt's going to be on the line, I'm not going to be protected in a certain way. Sure. I think that would help ease some of these concerns. But it's kind of scary when we grew up in probably the same era where you grew up watching these mob flicks, you know,
yep.
You know, the Goodfellas and Casinos and Heat.
Untouchables.
And
yeah.
Untouchables, you know, and it's like they were made men. And that's kind of how, you know, the community kind of feels. They're kind of made men, you know. They're out shopping, and
that's a really good analogy. Wow. Okay, I'm gonna use that. I like that. Yeah, you're right.
So hopefully it'll get better. And like I said, dialogues like this, I really appreciate your time. I know we were trying to schedule, we had conflicts, but really thank you for carving this time out, man, to share your story and open up. Is there anything else you want to share? You have any projects or anything that you're working on? Or
no, I don't have anything big coming up. I'm you know, when we have social unrest and things like that come up, you know, I always get offers to come around my mouth, but nothing big, man. I appreciate your time. I appreciate the opportunity to do it. And I'm glad Curtis hooked us up. I look forward to continue to collaborate where we can.
Definitely, man. If you have any courses coming up that the public is open, please let me know, because I would definitely like to attend.
Okay, absolutely. I'll do so.
All right, man. You be blessed, man. Much love.
All right, take care.
I hope these authentic stories show different paths to success and provide mentorship. Please be sure to visit us at drjinterviews.com for additional content and social media info. Stay resilient.